My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform, and I'm going to talk whether you listen or not. I want to welcome you to this program, looking at how states can deal with shifts in eligibility for public insurance programs like Medicaid, at the same time subsidies for private insurance through the exchanges that are supposed to start operating in 2014. That welcome is extended on behalf of Senator Rockefeller, our board of directors. We appreciate your attendance, and we look forward to your vigorous participation in a conversation. When the exchanges start operating in 2014 and Medicaid eligibility both expands and gets a little more standardized from place to place, there are going to be millions of people who find themselves eligible either for public coverage in Medicaid or SCHIP perhaps, or for subsidies for private coverage through the exchanges. And since family incomes and circumstances change over time, huge numbers of people are going to find that their eligibility has changed or maybe been lost or maybe been lost and regained in a different program. In other words, it's going to be a very complicated situation. Those transitions could very well be quite jarring for the families affected and, frankly, could present some challenging administrative problems for the states who are trying to sort all this stuff out. And as the states wrestle with how to structure their agencies in this reform era, we thought that it would be timely to examine exactly what kind of problems might be encountered with this so-called churning phenomenon and what policy tools might help to minimize the disruption and expense that otherwise we might incur. Our partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Commonwealth Fund, has done a tremendous amount of work in looking at the transition between the current healthcare system and the one that is scheduled to be phased in over the next several years under the Affordable Care Act. And joining me as co-moderator today is Sarah Collins, the fund's vice president for affordable health insurance, who also happens to be a particularly expert in this area. And we've asked Sarah to give us a bit of context for this coverage continuity question, if you will, that our panel is going to address. Sarah?
Thank you, Ed. I'm actually going to take a pretty high-level look at this before we dig down into the details and provide just a really brief overview of where the federal and states are, federal and state governments are in their implementation of the Affordable Care Act. This shows you the timeline for implementation of the coverage provisions in the law. The insurance reforms, in particular, have gone into effect last year, and some are being rolled out this year, starting in 2014. Those are when the major provisions go into effect. Like as Ed said, a substantial expansion in Medicaid eligibility and subsidized private coverage through the new state insurance exchanges. The state insurance exchanges are really the centerpiece of the Affordable Care Act. They're new regulated marketplaces where individuals and small employers can purchase health insurance, much of it which will be subsidized, and will provide ideally one-stop shopping for people looking for coverage in both Medicaid and subsidized private plans. States are required to establish an individual and a small group exchange. They can actually merge the two if they want to. If they decline to establish an exchange or HHS determines by January of 2014 that they are not able to, HHS will work with states to help them set up an exchange. Congressional budget estimates that about 34 million people will become newly covered in 2020. This is about an estimated 16 million people will gain coverage through Medicaid. 18 million more will gain coverage through the exchange or employer plans. Medicaid, as Deborah Bachrach points out in the paper in your inner brief, when you include the over 65 population, is going to be the largest insurance carrier in the country. It'll insure 25% of the population. With shifts of people moving from individual market and employer plans, and also small groups buying coverage through the exchange for their employees, about 30 million people will be covered through the insurance exchanges. HHS has been awarding grants to states to plan and establish their exchanges through planning grants issued last year, and then new establishment grants that states are in the process of applying for last year, level one or level two grants, depending on how long and how far along they are in their process. Most states will need to pass legislation in order to establish their exchanges. This map is based on the National Conference of State Legislatures tracking database. Six states have signed legislation in place. Dark blue states on the map, Massachusetts. In addition to Massachusetts, California, Maryland, Washington, West Virginia, and Utah. Several other states, the turquoise states, have legislation that has passed one or both houses, and many are ready for the governor's signature. Governors in Vermont, Colorado, and Hawaii, for example, are ready to sign their legislation shortly. The New Mexico governor vetoed legislation that had passed both houses. Louisiana has notified HHS that it will not be established in exchange. Governors in the light blue states have pursued or are considering alternatives to establishing exchanges, such as issuing executive orders that will do so. In many states, the purple states on this map, bills introduced have installed for several months. And in states that are white, legislation for the most part has not been introduced or has actually failed. Six states in a consortium of New England states were awarded early innovator grants to develop exchange information technology infrastructure that can be adopted and tailored by other states. The IT systems must be interoperable and integrated with state Medicaid programs. The focus of the panel today, and one of the key issues that these and other states are going to be dealing with, is how to create an enrollment process across Medicaid and subsidized private coverage that will allow people to easily enroll in the coverage that they're eligible for and also maintain that coverage, as Ed mentioned, when their incomes change or when they move between jobs. People with incomes up to 133% of poverty will be eligible for Medicaid. Those with incomes up to 400% of poverty without employer-based coverage will be eligible for private coverage through the exchanges. Premium subsidies will be available on a sliding scale that cap their premium cost, people's premium cost, from 2% to 9.5% of their income. Subsidized coverage through the exchanges will be tied to the Silver Plan, which will cover about 70% on average of someone's medical expenses. To offset those costs, people with incomes under 250% of poverty will be eligible for sliding scale cost-sharing tax credits. In addition, the out-of-pocket limits are reduced for families with incomes under 400% of poverty. One of the major goals of the Affordable Care Act, clearly, is to reach and maintain near universal coverage in each state. How well federal and state policymakers address the issues that are going to be explored by the panel today will have an important role in how well we're able to achieve those goals. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Sarah. Just a couple of housekeeping announcements. You have packets that have the papers that Sarah was referring to and a bunch of other stuff, and a list which is duplicated on our website, allhealth.org, so that you can click on things and get a much more extensive list of resources that might be helpful in answering your next levels of questions. There will be available on Monday a webcast of this briefing through the auspices of the Kaiser Family Foundation, thank you very much, on kff.org, and transcript a few days later on our website at allhealth.org. And you'll find in those packets two things I want to call to your attention. Again, a green card on which you can write a question at the appropriate time. You can also come to one of the microphones and ask the question orally. And a blue evaluation form, which, if you do not fill out, you will not be permitted to leave. We're working on that. But we would appreciate your filling them out so that we can improve these programs as we go along. We've got a great panel today to talk about some of the issues that Sarah has alluded to. And we're going to start with Pamela Farley Short. Pam is on the faculty at Penn State. She directs its Center for Healthcare and Policy Research. Her own research has to do with how people's insurance is connected to their income and their employment and their overall health. You'll find a paper by Pam and her colleagues in your packets commissioned by the Commonwealth Fund that lays out the major possible pitfalls for people trying to maintain their coverage under the ACA as their life circumstances change. And it was really that that triggered our thoughts about the possibility of doing a briefing that could build on the excellent work that is encompassed in that paper and in the presentation you're about to hear from Pam Farley Short. Pam, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ed. Let me start by thanking the Commonwealth Fund for supporting our work on this topic. And I also want to thank my collaborators, Kathy Swartz from Harvard, Namrata Ubaroy, who's a PhD student working with me, and Deborah Grafe, who's also at Penn State. So the reforms that will be implemented in 2014 pull together coverage from a variety of sources in order to offer universal access to affordable insurance and hopefully to get something close to universal coverage as well. So at the center of these reforms are the individual health insurance exchanges that will offer premium credits for some enrollees, those specifically that lack access to employment-based insurance and who have incomes between 133% and 400% of the federal poverty line. There will also be small employer exchanges, which can be separate or combined with the individual exchange. The states get to decide that. Medicaid, as Sarah said, will be expanded so that everyone under 133% of the poverty line will be on Medicaid. And don't be confused. I think today we will sometimes say that people up to 138% of the poverty line will be on Medicaid, and others of us are saying 133. There is a 5% income disregard, so that effectively, which will not be counted, and so effectively Medicaid will go to 138% of the federal poverty line, but it's sort of one of those stars, little complications. And then the Children's Health Insurance Program is extended to 2019, and in the background, but actually also at the center of things, 3 out of 5 Americans will continue to be covered by employers. The jumping off point for today's session is, though, the realization that in this scheme, changes in income, changes in employment and access to employment-based insurance could cause lots of people to gain or lose coverage from these different sources over a year. When your income changes and you go over the limit for Medicaid, then what happens? And even family membership and who's in the family is going to matter, because the federal poverty line is adjusted for family size and depends on family composition. And the tax credits will be administered through tax units that also depend on who's living together and filing taxes together. So this leaves us with a major challenge in implementing the reforms that basically comes down to trying to figure out how are we going to maintain the guiding principles of covering everyone, affordability, shared responsibility, but how to define that and maintain it when someone's ability to pay for insurance is changing. It gets more complicated. And this isn't just a theoretical possibility. Here are some data that we tabulated from the Survey of Income and Program Participation that shows from 1 year to the next, and remember that the exchanges are going to sign people up in the fall for coverage in the coming year, and insurance income taxes are filed basically on an annual basis. So starting with the people who will qualify for Medicaid here who are below 133% of the poverty line. If you take that group and you look the next year to see what income category they're in, only 76% of them, about three quarters, stay in that category below 133% of poverty. The other one out of four have moved up and would then, instead of being eligible for Medicaid, would most likely be getting premium credits in the exchanges. And what's even more important, significant, is that the greatest volatility in incomes is in the group just above that, 133 to 200% of the federal poverty line. Those are the people who would be in the exchanges in 1 year, but the next year, only about half of them would still be in that category where they're getting the biggest premium credits, the most generous premium credits from through the federal tax system. The other people would have moved, some of them, 17% on the left in the red will move down to Medicaid, and others will move up into less generous premium credits or even a very small percentage out of the exchange. Even decisions about the small employer exchange are going to figure here because low-income workers are concentrated in small firms. So this lowest income group is the longest bar at the bottom of my slide, and it declines as you go up the income distribution. So coordinating Medicaid with premium credits to buy insurance in the exchange is going to be critical. First off, many new enrollees in either of those programs are going to be coming from the other program. It adds another large federal bureaucracy, the Internal Revenue Service, to what's already a rather complicated partnership involving in Medicaid with the federal state enrolls there. We have a history of, we know that it takes special efforts to get high participation rates in Medicaid and CHIP, so it's not just enough to offer people eligibility. You have to work hard at getting into them into these programs and keeping them in the programs. And the tax credits are going to be based on annual income, but Medicaid eligibility is based on income over a shorter time period. And the law says at the time of application. But I'm not just here to point out the problems. We actually have a number of policy solutions in this policy brief that was released by the Commonwealth Fund yesterday. Our suggestions come at a... Oh, thank you. Got behind in my slide work. Our suggestions come at an admittedly high level, and Deborah and Don are going to fill in some of the details beneath, but... One of those suggestions is just to be very clear that the eligibility and navigation systems that are going to help people get into the exchanges and find their place and the right, see what they qualify for, those systems really need to be designed to help people cope not just with getting in the door, but with changes in their eligibility. So we use these words about a single point of entry, a portal, it all is kind of this image of coming in. But really, we need to put a lot of emphasis on the handoffs and think of this as helping people move from one program to another. And the exchanges and people who are helping folks with their eligibility are going to be able to answer the questions that individuals are going to have about, you know, what if my income goes up next year, or what if I get a job, or what if I lose my job, what if scenarios to help them figure out what they want to do and what really is essentially still a voluntary system because people have the option of paying the penalty and going without insurance. Another possibility is for states to consider their option of creating a state basic health plan that would bring everyone under 200% of the poverty line basically under the state's umbrella, and that would help to coordinate between Medicaid and the income group that's just above Medicaid. It would also be possible to extend Medicaid and CHIP eligibility through the next open season to the end of the year. So instead of moving people in and out of those programs, since everyone's going to choose their plan every fall, through transitional Medicaid assistance and 12-month continuous eligibility and some other options that are really already part of those programs, it would be possible to leave people where they are and not go to all this trouble for them and states and the exchanges to move them around. We also suggest that this may be a reason to combine the individual and the small employer exchanges, because after all, if those are unified, then when people leave a small employer and would have to get coverage on their own, they wouldn't have to move to a different exchange and perhaps a different set of plans. That would be more seamless. And finally, that even if we leave the exchanges separate or we have Medicaid and CHIP and exchanges, one of the things that states can do is to think carefully about the plans that they're contracting with, so that people would have access to the same plans whether or not they're being covered through Medicaid or through the exchanges, or even if not the same plans, at least the same provider networks. So in our mind, none of these suggestions that I've put on the table here would require new federal legislation. And simplifying will not only benefit people whose lives are in flux or going through these changes, but are also going to reduce administrative costs. To us, it seems like the most promising way to simplify are actually to unify these programs. I think that's a theme that you may hear more this afternoon. And to let people stay put. The easiest way to smooth transitions and avoid gaps is to not have transitions. Thanks.
And just to clarify, some of the others you mentioned explicitly, but the combining of the individual and the small group market exchanges is something the states have the power to do at their discretion?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks very much. Next, we're going to turn to Deborah Bachrach, who's currently a special counsel to the law firm Manat, Phelps, and Phillips. And before coming to Manat, she had directed New York's Medicaid program for several years. She has a rich background of work on health policy and financing issue, having advised a whole range of groups, including the new Medicaid and CHIP Payment and Access Commission, MACPAC. Deborah's also written quite a useful document that you'll find in your kits, the roadmap for states looking to structure Medicaid's role in the new exchanges, and we're very pleased that she could join us today. Deborah?
Thank you. The slide that I usually start with that's missing from this presentation, but I'm going to take the liberty of telling you this, and it is really the premise of how we achieve continuity of coverage in the exchange. Is Medicaid is health insurance, and we have to keep reminding ourselves that it's changed dramatically since the 60s, and it's now health insurance, and we're looking at, and Pam said it, I wrote it down, coordinating Medicaid with premium coverage will be critical, and I couldn't agree more. This workflow starts with the individuals coming into the exchange who don't know whether they're eligible for a subsidy or not, because they have no clue whether they are at 2% of the federal poverty level or 200% of the federal poverty level. And Donald talked more about that front end and the eligibility determination and redetermination. But what I want to just focus your attention on here is once an individual has been told they're eligible for a subsidy, now that could be a full subsidy under Medicaid, close to full subsidy if a state chooses to do a basic health plan, or a more partial subsidy through a qualified health plan. At that point, they know their subsidy level and they will choose a plan. And I particularly want to look at this through states that are now operating their Medicaid managed care plans, and increasingly you will find states doing this through Medicaid managed care plans, so that once your subsidy option is determined or your subsidy level is determined, you will move into choosing a plan among the plans that offer the product for which you're eligible. Now, looking at it from the point of view of the individual in the exchange, the Affordable Care Act defines state health subsidy programs, and it really plays into my point, if you will, very proud, that Medicaid is coverage in the continuum of coverage. So there are four state health subsidy options. Medicaid, and as Pam said, I use the one below 139 because I build in the 5%. CHIP, which starts at 139 and goes up to a state ceiling, which can be as high as 400%. The basic health program, which is an option for 139 to 200%, and then qualified health plans offering subsidized coverage up to 400%, and those, and then qualified health plans without a subsidy for those above 400%. Now, the goal is to achieve continuity of coverage among these options in the exchange. And from my point of view, what's the goal? Why do we care about this? Well, the first, and this is the topic for today, it's about facilitating transitions as income switches. But I think it bears mentioning that integrating coverage or continuity of coverage is equally vital to states, and increasingly states are focusing on this because it leverages their buying power, which enables states to influence not only price, but to drive payment and delivery system reform. And this is very much on states' minds. So in the next slides, we go through some of the ways that we can achieve integration and continuity. And the issue that this slide depicts is, will the plans in the exchange offer all products? In other words, if you start from the bottom and work up, well, we have a qualified health plan that's also offering a basic health program, assuming the state takes that option, and is also offering a Medicaid managed care product. There's obvious desirability to that approach because individuals will then be able to move and stay within the same plan. But there are Medicaid managed care plans that are very good at providing care to vulnerable populations who may not be positioned to be a QHP, and there may be QHPs that have no interest in contracting with the state's Medicaid agency. And so then there's the middle option, which is some choose to. And what states are thinking about is, what levers do I have to at a minimum encourage Medicaid plans to move into the QHP space and for QHPs to move into the Medicaid space? Because at a minimum, all states would like to at least see some overlap in coverage. This will raise another really tricky issue for states is provider networks, because as much as we would like individuals to stay within the same plan as their income changes, we want them to be able to maintain the same primary care physician and, for those with chronic illness, specialty physicians. And so will the provider network look the same in your Medicaid managed care product and your QHP product? Experience suggests not always. And two, even when they do, how will payment rates affect this? Because I can see some of you nodding, Medicaid managed care plans traditionally track to fee-for-service rates, which tend to be lower, all of which are sort of being thought about now by states as they roll out the exchange and think about where Medicaid fits in. The next three slides really speak to the extent you don't have complete uniformity of plans, and I think in most states you will not have complete uniformity of plans, we can align the plans through our requirements, through our quality requirements, our network requirements, and our marketing requirements. And here's where I think a lot of this notion of, are you going to be a passive or an active exchange, is really overstated, because the ACA makes it clear that there are certain requirements that a QHP must meet, Medicaid-managed care plans have an awful lot of requirements they now meet. I mean, in New York, we had strict quality, access, network requirements. So what we want, what we're trying to depict in these three slides is the degree to which the state will want to align their requirements for quality, for network, for access, for marketing, and for reporting across all of the plans participating in the exchange, and by, when I say that, I mean including your Medicaid managed care and basic health plans. So the this one looks at the certification requirements, building off of what's in the ACA for QHPs. This is our quality strategies, and this goes back to my point about leveraging your plans in the exchange to drive quality, and then on reporting requirements, so that we are aligning our insurance products in the exchange regardless of the income and the subsidy eligibility of the individual. Benefit options. This is tricky, and if I had more time, I'd have a 3 or 4 slides following this. But the QHP must offer an essential benefit package, and that's in your first row, and that we're waiting for HHS to put more detail to that. But whatever it is, states must provide a minimum benchmark to newly eligible, so that's all childless adults, and depending on your state, some parents up to 138 or 133% of the federal poverty level. The minimum benchmark that must be offered to the newly eligible is column 2, and when states offer that benchmark, they receive an enhanced FMAP starting at 100%. The maximum benchmark could mirror your standard Medicaid, subject to approval by HHS. And states are making decisions on this now, or thinking about this now, and part of what's driving it is how do I ensure and maximize my ability to get enhanced FMAP? How do I align benefits so I don't have cliffs? There are an awful lot of questions here about aligning your standard Medicaid, which will apply to your children, some parents, your newly eligibles, along with your QHP or benchmark. The last piece that I want to talk about is how to use a basic health plan. And increasingly, we're getting states asking about this. The first level of interest came from states that were covering parents with incomes above 133% of the federal poverty level. And that's what you're seeing in New York, where we cover parents up to 150%. So is this an option where we can create a bridge between our lowest income individuals and our slightly more moderate income individuals? And the way the federal law reads is it's available for the 139 to 200 group. It can include legal immigrants who are not eligible for Medicaid because they've been here for less than 5 years. And the federal government will provide 95% of the subsidies it would otherwise have made available for these individuals, as well as additional dollars to reflect the out-of-pocket offset. A question for HHS was whether that's 95% or 100%. But it is the sense that the states can purchase a more comprehensive benefit package and offer it at lower cost sharing by going into the market. And by doing so, making it more affordable for this still relatively low income group, align it with the Medicaid product, and transition more smoothly over to the QHP. When I went back, because I can't tell you how many questions I'm getting about this now, and I read the statute, what I was struck by was the number of requirements regarding the quality levers to be built into BHPs, which really, again, suggests that the ACA sets us up to think about quality and delivery system reform across our health plans, again, from Medicaid through BHP and through QHP. And I think that for me, that's the point that I would want to leave you with, which is this is our opportunity to once and for all yank Medicaid out of the sort of welfare poverty program mode, move it into becoming what I call a mission-driven, fiscally disciplined health insurance program and align it with BHPs and the QHPs to ensure continuity of coverage and to maximize our leverage in the delivery system. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Feel free. Let me just ask you one other quick clarifying question. If a state does choose to put in place a basic health plan, that still will be a product ultimately provided by a private insurance company. Is that right?
Well,
the
wording of the statute says it sets up a clear preference for a health plan to offer it. So the question then will be, will it be offered by your Medicaid managed care plans? Will it be offered by QHPs or both?
Great. Thank you. Well, you've heard a couple of experts describing the problems and the potential solutions. Now you're going to hear from somebody who's had to wrestle with this in real life. Our final speaker is Don Gregory. He is the Medicaid director in the Louisiana Department of Health. He's a native Louisianan. He's been in the department for many years. For 9 years, in fact, he chaired the CMS Technical Advisory Group on Fraud and Abuse Control. In the last decade, Don's overseen some dramatic improvement on how Louisiana's Medicaid CHIP programs enroll and retain eligible folks, and now he's grappling with how he'll coordinate with the exchange in Louisiana, which is likely, amazingly, to be run by CMS and not a Louisiana entity. So I'm looking forward to hearing how you're juggling the various variables that you're coming across in this transition period, Don. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Ed. I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon, and I'm going to assume that you can read faster than I talk, and so I'm going to let you read these slides behind me, and I'm not going to try to read them to you. There's some bullet points here that I want to tell you about that are important. I'm going to tell you very quickly about a 12-year journey that we've been on to solve churn within our Medicaid and CHIP program. I'm mostly going to talk about children because that's mostly who we cover in our Medicaid program, in our CHIP program in our state. And I'm also going to talk about how we evolved from a very typical welfare, if you will, eligibility process into something that's very, very different. And we think that new model of eligibility determination for us has implications for our work with the exchange, not only in our state, but our lessons there that can be used across other states as well. This is kind of the lay of the land, if you will. Nothing on this slide that anyone would be proud of. This is kind of where we were in 1998 when CHIP was introduced, and we got all excited about the opportunities that came with CHIP. We did lots of outreach. We partnered with new community partners that we had never worked with before to do outreach and enrollment, and we thought we were off running on something new and great in our state. We discovered fairly quickly that we weren't quite as good at what doing this as we might be. We were losing at redetermination once CHIP had been in place for a year. We were losing more kids at re-enrollment than we were enrolling through the front door. And so we were actually having net losses in eligibility because of churn. It would be great if these kids all suddenly became members of families that were doing so much better and that therefore didn't need the coverage that we were offering. That's not the case. These kids were still eligible for the most part. They simply couldn't, or their parents wouldn't, navigate our eligibility process to keep them enrolled in our system. We set out to redesign and get away from this very paper-bound, face-to-face interview eligibility process and to adopt processes that would allow us to reduce, if not eliminate, churn within our program. And some of the things that we started doing was we started looking very closely for information that was in other computer systems that we could use, that we didn't have to rely on the parents of these children to provide information to us. We adopted some very simple technology that would help us achieve better outcomes in our enrollment process. And we looked at to see if we were doing some things that we internally call administratively stupid. I mean, we did them because we've always done them that way, but, you know, did it really serve any purpose? And out of late, we've really adopted something that we're particularly proud of. In our express lane eligibility, we have one computer system talking to another computer system to determine renewals, and we're doing about 7,500 renewals a month, which no person touches. One computer system is touching another computer system, and we're generating notices automatically, and we have somebody that's kind of watching over this IT system to make sure that they keep talking to each other, but there is no eligibility involvement in it whatsoever, which we really are proud of. But, you know, a big thing for us was in the key point on this slide is that we started looking hard to see what else was out there instead of relying on asking over and over again for people to provide us some information that we either already had ourselves or that some partner agency had in their system already. We started looking to see what we could glean from other systems that were available to us that would help us. In particular, I really like the information in food stamp cases. Food stamp cases are very granular in detail. A $3 change in income makes a $1 difference in benefits. It's a very slow, laborious process to determine eligibility for food stamps, quite costly process. Every food stamp director I ever met was obsessed with error rates because they get penalized if they have very high error rates in the food stamp program. So there's great granular detail in a food stamp case. Wouldn't particularly want to be tied from a Medicaid or CHIP perspective closely with that process because I can go really fast and therefore fairly cheap in my eligibility processes because I don't have to be that precise. It's only important for me when it gets close to a tipping point between Medicaid or CHIP or between CHIP and ineligibility that I really be careful. And so therefore, I don't need as much information to determine eligibility as the food stamp folks do. But food stamp information is great, and I'd love to get my hands on it when I can. One of the things that we adopted was really low-tech. We simply started using the darn telephone. We started picking up the phone and calling people. We found out they like it. They don't like getting letters in the mail from us reminding them they're supposed to do something. Fill out a form, mail it back. And so we started say we would send them a notice and say, call us when it's convenient. And they would call. And my eligibility workers will tell you to a person that they get better information out of a brief telephone interview than they get on a signed renewal form. And so we simply adopted, you know, Graham Bell's great invention and have used it extensively in our eligibility process. Again, for these reasons. It's key. It was a key component. And this is not expensive technology. Somebody didn't have to come build me a $10 million computer system. I mean, almost everybody that you know has a cell phone. Find somebody that doesn't. So phone contact works extremely well. I throw this slide up here so that you will see visually what I've been talking about. 12 years ago, all of this would have been paper. We would have mailed somebody a application form or a renewal form. We would have set up an interview for them. We'd had them come in and sit in a waiting room. We would have interviewed them about this. We don't do that anymore. We don't do face-to-face interviews. We rarely do any paperwork at all. It's less than 5% of our work now and declining. You'll see a small bit of web work here now. Some states do more work on the web than we do, and we think that's going to grow. I think paper process ineligibility will pretty soon be almost a dinosaur. It'll be the rare, rare exception. Most of what we do in the way of renewals, we can either find it in another system, we can get it over the telephone, or we can simply, the administrative piece of it is we started looking at our processes, and this is where I was talking about being administratively stupid, we realized that about a third of our eligibility cases never closed. These people were in situations where their situation just doesn't change. It's a children living with a grandparent. The grandparent's income doesn't count. It's somebody that has Social Security income. It's not going to change much. A little bit, maybe January 1st each year. Those people are extremely stable. So why do I need an eligibility worker to contact them and do a renewal? So what we simply start doing is we send them a notice saying, this is what we have on file in our system about you. You call us and tell us if it's changed. And it's amazing. They will call. So we simply send them an annual renewal showing what we have on file, and they will call our hotline and tell us if something's changed. Works really, really well. To show you an example of what this means, This is actual renewals for children in our program from last August. We renewed over 45,000 kids, almost 46,000. We closed only 327 kids because we couldn't find them. We couldn't get a form from their parent or for some reason. Now, we closed other kids that were no longer eligible, but for procedural reasons, we only closed 300 kids. Under our old process, we would have closed over 10,000 of these 45,000 kids. And it's not because they weren't eligible. They simply couldn't jump through the hoops that we had out there to redetermine their eligibility. For you budget folks out there, you'll probably like this slide. I certainly, as a manager, like this slide. Adopting these processes, actually, our clients like them, but they actually save us money. We have computed very precisely that we save over $10 million a year by adopting these renewal processes that I've described to you rather than doing a paper renewal process. It cost us about 50% more to do a new application than it does to do a renewal. So for every person that we can keep in the program and do some kind of renewal on, we've saved money. And for the administrative renewals at the bottom, we have 939,000 cases in our system. We were able to administratively renew about 288,000 of those. I would need about another 160 eligibility workers employed in my system to be able to do those if I was still doing a manual process. We have embraced technology in a big way, and this has really helped us get where we are today. But technology in and of itself doesn't solve your solution things. We actually, one of the things that we did do was adopt an electronic case record. Back 2004, it was fully deployed. And it has done a remarkable thing for us. It freed us up to do some of the business changes that I'm describing to you. And if electronic health records does for the healthcare industry what electronic eligibility records have done for us, it'll be worth every penny Congress spent on it. We pursued paperless records for lots of reasons. Lost records, really burdensome. I used to have to really work hard at employing eligibility staff where the work was, and I don't do that anymore. I simply move the work to wherever the staff are. All of the applications that are taken in the Baton Rouge area in my state are actually processed in a small office out of central Louisiana. No one would know that outside of my office because I can simply move the work very easily to wherever I have a staff to handle it. We don't. These are actually file records. Once we converted to our electronic file record, these were waiting to be destroyed. Couldn't resist taking a photo of this. I don't spend money on file rooms anymore. Used to spend anywhere $15, $18, $20 a square foot for file rooms. I don't need them. So I don't spend rental money on file rooms. I don't have the reason to do that. This is what enrollment has happened or has looked like in my state for the oops, I think I missed one. Yeah, let me go back to this one. I would like to tell you that I was really smart and that I built this electronic case record thinking that someday there might be a disaster and I would need it, but it never occurred to me that there would be. But I'll tell you, I lost four offices in New Orleans through Katrina. I had over 35,000 of my recipients scattered to the winds. I had 185 eligibility staff scattered to the winds. But I only lost about 300 applications that had been received in the mail that day and had yet to be scanned into our system. Nothing else was lost of importance out of that process. A huge, huge plus to having an eligibility electronic record. This is the caseload record. I'm going to move quickly. I'm out of time. These are the enrollment records for the last 10 years, and this is not going to change under national health care reform. This is, if anything, is probably going to accelerate a bit and even go up. This is the delta, if you will, between the staff, the eligibility staff that I have, and the workload. The system should be under tremendous stress. We should be having problems keeping up with the work, and we should be having problems with the quality in our system, but we're not, at least not yet. I don't know how long we can keep this up. But so far, the processing times are good, and the quality is very good, and it's because of these investments, because we have reinvented our eligibility model. If we had not, we would be drowning. As much as I've talked about technology, I want to tell you very quickly that the caseworkers are more important than anything else. I have a little bit over 500 eligibility workers. They have, on average, about 17 years experience each. They're really, really good. And what I try to use them for are things that I need them for, and not to use them doing busy work. And so I keep them involved in things that are really important around those tipping points that I talked about. We spend a lot of time, since we mostly insure children, talking to our eligibility staff about parental apathy. I wish the world was full of perfect parents, but it is not. And we have to realize that sometimes that we need to go the extra mile when that parent who should be doing these things does not, for whatever reason. And so it's part of our internal marketing, especially when it comes to children. Just so that if you're concerned that all these changes have resulted in us throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I used to work in program integrity for a long time, so I'm always very conscious of program integrity issues, and we have a very, very good error rate. I'll take this one to the bank any day. I started with a slide of where we were 12 years ago, and I'm at the end, and I want to kind of tell you where we are today. We still have challenges. We still have a very poor state. We still have abysmal outcomes in our healthcare delivery system, but we have done remarkable things to get at least the children in our state insured. We're one of the best in the country now at doing that. And so we've come a long way in a dozen years. And I think there are lessons through things that we have learned over the last 12 years that will certainly help us deal with the federal exchange that I'll be dealing with, and will certainly help us be ready for national health care reform when it comes. It is a puzzle. It isn't just one thing. It's just not technology. It's not just redefining your business process. It is a bunch of things. It is a puzzle, and you need all these pieces working to make it work. And I know I'm out of time, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you, Don. Now you get a chance to ask the questions that have been burning in your head for the last hour and 10 minutes. There are, as I mentioned, microphones on either side, and you can infer from Ebby's holding up the green card that if you hand her that card, it will end up here, and the other staff the same way. If you do come to the microphone, we'd ask that you keep the question as brief as you can, so we'll get more time for more questions, and that you identify yourself. And there you go. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, thank you. My name is Rob Nelb, and my question was, I was hoping the panel could talk a little bit about some of the coverage coordination challenges for children, particularly children and CHIP, whose parents will be in the exchange. And I guess one of the recommendations was encouraging states to take up the basic health program for those under 200% of the federal poverty level. And I was wondering about the coordination challenges there as well between basic health program and CHIP.
Go ahead, Deborah.
Well, that's the question. I mean, it's for children and for adults. And I think one is, to the extent we have plans that are offering all products, that, of course, makes it easier. And so, I mean, I think that is really a goal that every state has, which is to have at least one option where a family can be in one plan so that, right, their children are in CHIP in, you know, Plan X, and the parents are in QHP with a level of subsidy in the same plan. And then when the child's, you know, when income changes, or if CHIP is eliminated, then the child either moves into the QHP or the BHP. I do want to say, I think one of the challenges with the BHP is if we don't do it right, we're going to have more points at which families and individuals will lose coverage. Instead of once going from Medicaid to QHP, you'll go from Medicaid to BHP, possibly lose coverage, go from BHP to QHP. So I think BHP is a tremendous opportunity if done right.
Yes, thank you to all of you present today. My question is directed at Mr. Gregory. Just one of the things you mentioned was you have about 500 eligibility workers and about 17 years average experience in a lot of states mm-hmm. or maybe in a similar position. Lots of people that have been doing it the same way they've always done it. And obviously you've done some really great things, so congratulations. Can you just give me a little more detail on
exactly how you've increased the ability of caseload per worker and kind of what's your length of time for the application process and that sort of thing. Thank you.
Be glad to. It certainly wasn't easy. It never is to make major cultural changes within a bureaucracy, especially when you change something that's been in place probably 40 years or more. We actually were the benefactor of a Robert Woods Johnson Foundation grant that we used to deploy a Toyota-style continuous process improvement. We brought in some facilitators that help us do that, and we have employed a full-time person that's their sole job is for continuous process improvement and working with our staff. And it's a bottom-up. At first, our staff didn't really believe that they could have a voice in the way that we do things, but over time, we convinced them that, you know, some of the very best ideas come from frontline workers and frontline supervisors. And so once we had some early adapters that would take the try at trying something new and found ways to work, we did a lot of small-scale testing. You know, we weren't scared to fail, and we had lots of small failures along the way. But it was basically a long process. It was not easy. There were some people, I think, that moved to retirement rather than adjust to the new processes. But they saw the benefit once, and they were the ones that came up with the ideas for the most part for things that we were doing. So it's kind of been that cultural approach.
Yes, go ahead. I'm Stan Dorn from the Urban Institute, and first I want to congratulate the Alliance and Commonwealth for a phenomenal panel. I'm just really an extraordinary group of presenters, so thank you for doing this for all of us. I have a question about the notion of Medicaid plans and the exchange, because that has a huge amount of appeal, but I'm worried about the issue of provider reimbursement, which Deborah pointed out, and you know the concern is largely because of Medicaid provider reimbursement rates far below private levels. If you control for risk and you look at a working population, private insurance is about 30% more expensive than Medicaid. Here's the concern. Suppose you have a Medicaid plan in the exchange and it's paying its providers Medicaid rates. And suppose that plan winds up being the second lowest cost silver plan, which is the reference premium. Well, the amount of that everybody pays in the exchange, if you're a subsidy recipient, is based in part on income, but also it's based on the difference between the reference premium, that second lowest cost premium, that's a silver plan, and whatever plan I enroll in. So if Medicaid comes in and, notwithstanding more comprehensive benefits, offers a product that's much cheaper than private insurance, my fear is that people in the exchange up to 400% FPL will find it extremely expensive to enroll in standard insurance. So maybe that's okay, but I think it's something that concerns me.
This is the second time this issue has been posed to me, and I really have to dig into this more, Stan, so we have to have a longer discussion. But I don't think that it's likely that let me step back. When I talk about Medicaid in the exchange, I don't necessarily think that the Medicaid plan is a QHP. You can have a QHP that is offering a Medicaid product, but I don't believe that Medicaid product will become your second lowest silver plan. And I think that's what we have to look at so that we avoid the problem that you're talking about, because I understand the risk of it, but what we have to do is figure out how to address it, because the answer can't be, and I think you'll agree with me, well, we don't put Medicaid into the exchange.
Right. But that too has a problem to the Medicaid agency, because for that to achieve continuity, the Medicaid product offered by the QHP has to be a Medicaid contracting plan, which the state pays for. And if it's the same provider network with high payment rates, that means the state Medicaid agency is going to be on the hook paying 30% more than it does for, or what, you know, a huge percent more than it does.
I think that's the issue we have to grapple with, because, again, I think we agree on the goal. The goal makes sense, and it may be that it places some, don't kill me, Don, upward pressure on Medicaid rates. Maybe it brings down some of the, if I can, overpayment by the commercial plans, and it begins to shake out. But I think it's the discussion we have to have in order to bring Medicaid into the coverage world.
Stan, I'll add from a Medicaid perspective that Medicaid is not always the most robust payer, for sure. And I can get away with that, if you will, when I have a fairly small market share, because the Blue Crosses and the Humanas of the world make up for what I failed to pay my private hospitals. I'm paying them about 70% of their cost currently in my state. I don't know that I'll be able to continue to do that once national health care reforms fully, and we recognize that now. So I think we're going, this is going to make Medicaid a better payer for services than it historically been.
Wow, great.
It's an excellent point, and I think it also points to the importance of keeping a close eye on quality measures and measures of the quality of the network and the size of the network. Especially if we're paying less. I mean, if we could get away with paying at Medicaid rates and get the same network as you get with commercial payers, that would be nirvana, but that's probably not likely.
Next.
Rodney, go ahead.
Rodney Whitlock with Senator Grassley. Medicaid staffer emeritus, I think. During the 09 debate, there was a floor chart that I thought was particularly insightful that really got into the question of, did the Affordable Care Act create a wall, effectively, between Medicaid and the commercial market, the above 133/138 market? And ultimately, is it going to be a bifurcated system? I mean, this panel and this whole presentation is certainly talks about the way to break those down. But the folks who really can best speak to this, with due respect to the panel, and not meaning to insult you all in any way, but the folks that most speak to this are the insurers and CMS. AHIP in 2009, before the Baucus roundtables back then, which seems like a million years ago now, testified that their commercial plans, their non-Medicaid market plans, did not want to cover individuals in Medicaid. So the folks that, you can lay out that an AHIP commercial plan could ease the transition, bridge the wall, since we're working in metaphors here, between the Medicaid individuals and the commercial market and solve a lot of the problems we're talking about here. Because functionally, that would, again, break down the wall, and someone stays in the same coverage, same doctors, and all it is a payor, and it's all behind the curtain, black box. They don't know what happens, just the payor changes. Right? But that's presumes that those plans will participate. Second half, you have the Medicaid payors, and I think it's pretty obvious, the ACAPs of the world. Meg Murray, are you here before I insult you? Meg Murray, okay, she'd be perfectly happy having a monopoly in the state up to 200%. And she also has the advantage position of being nonprofits, which she has over for-profits. So they would be in an advantaged position to do that. I think one of the interesting things on the BHPs and their development is whether or not the providers in the state are going to get wise to what could happen here and use their lobbying ability state to state to try to tamp down BHPs, because BHPs necessarily, to work, are going to have to work on payment rates similar to what are done in the Medicaid managed care market. And then the other side of the equation, of course, is CMS. And CMS has to create a regulatory environment where any of this will work, because they can effectively, and I would argue, in Cindy's reinterpretation of 1937 to cover transportation, absolutely makes it difficult for a commercial AHIP plan to want to play in the sub-133 space, and that they can do the same in choosing to try to morph basic health plan to benchmark plan. So, again, respectfully, you guys are a good panel, but the people who actually decide this are going to be the plans to participate in CMS and whether or not they're going to create an environment that allows it. Very curious your reaction, Deborah, since you're nodding.
Well, you made a lot of points, and so let's start with commercial plans do not want to participate in Medicaid. Now, there are lots of reasons why commercial plans may not want to participate in Medicaid, and I think we have to piece them apart. I'll give you one example, which is the state's not always a good partner. And if we're going to be running Medicaid, my terms, mission-driven, fiscally disciplined health insurer, I have to be a good partner. And so we need consistency, we need transparency, and we need accountability. So the state has to be a better partner. Two, when you look at the numbers What you're seeing, because there will be so many more Medicaid beneficiaries in this country by 2019 or 14, pick your date, you are seeing commercial plans looking at this business opportunity much more than I ever expected across the board. In fact, a lot of the pure play plans are getting very nervous because more commercial plans are looking at Medicaid. On the BHP point, some of the modeling that we're involved with is we're assuming provider rates that are 120% of Medicaid, so that it actually is genuinely a bridge. If Medicaid's 100, we're looking at BHP at 120, and let's say commercial at 130, whatever you know the numbers are. So I think it may be a way to become the bridge. It may deal with what Stan talked about, which is we can start to bring the provider networks more in line. So I do think that we can effectuate this. We can have those discussions with the providers, the commercial plans, and the pure Medicaid plans. And again, I think we have to, and we're having the same conversations with CMS. How do you create the regulatory framework that enables that?
Didn't I read last week that Blue Cross of Florida was entering the Medicaid market for the first time statewide? I don't know. Is that a harbinger of something that's going to be happening more often?
I also think the more we talk about Medicaid and the exchange and continuity of coverage across plans, that too will pique the interest of the commercial market more.
Hi. My name's Frank Mitchkay with McKenna Long and Aldridge. I had a question slightly variant from what we've been discussing, but I think it has to do with churn. Do you anticipate that the shop exchanges will be screening employees who enroll for Medicaid and their children for CHIP? And if so, how do you think that'll affect both the churn issue and the sustainability of the shop exchange pool?
And would whoever starts, whoever answers also start by explaining what a shop exchange is?
Those are the small employer exchanges.
And I don't know the answer to this. I was hoping somebody here would jump up and answer it. So I think I'm going to duck the question because I don't know enough about shop exchanges to give a smart answer, but I think it's a good question.
We haven't seen the systems yet or all the rules, but certainly the concept is that there will be one place in the state that everybody can go to figure out what they have coming to them. And to my way of thinking, that wouldn't make sense if it excluded the shop exchanges.
Ken Feingold, HHS Aspie. I want to ask Mr. Gregory to explain his governor's rationale for not establishing a state-level exchange. And I wanted to hear what the rest of the panel thought about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing for other states to make that same decision that they're going to let the federal government do it.
Not an authorized spokesperson for our governor, and not an appointed official by our governor, so I wouldn't presume to speak for him.
Don, nobody will know.
this know
is completely off the record. The webcast doesn't mean a thing.
From a Medicaid director perspective, I'll tell you this. I was rather agnostic about it. It didn't really matter to me much whether I dealt with a state exchange or a federal exchange. It's still going to be pretty much the same process for me, the same bridge that I need to cover. At least I know early who my partner is going to be, and I certainly will be engaging CMS in a dialogue on how we make that work. But it was interesting. I think at least in the press releases that I read about the decision, it was the unknown that was driving it. There were so many unknown factors was the rationale that they gave for their decision.
I would just add to what Don said, and he alluded to, is that all of the requirements in the ACA and all of the guidance that has come out of CSIO and CMS have been, you know, absolutely clear that the integration of the eligibility systems is required regardless of whether it's a federal exchange or a state exchange, and it's a requirement that's imposed on state Medicaid, so it has to happen. I think it may be more awkward if it's your partner is, you know, in Washington, and also you're bringing the federal exchange into your insurance markets, which has obvious implications.
And let me just add to that, a few weeks ago, Joel Ario from CSIO, who has something to do with the way exchanges are going to end up at the federal level, made the point that in states where the state either chose not to operate or HHS found them inadequate to operate, in both cases that defaults to the feds, that HHS intended not to make it a one-size-fits-all operation, that they would work very closely with each individual state to try to tailor that exchange to the needs of the rest of the operation.
Gregory, you talked a bit about...
Yep. You want to identify yourself, young lady?
I'm a health policy journalist. You've talked a lot about where you've come in the last 12 years and the gains you've made. Can you talk a little bit more in detail about what you do have to do to your Medicaid staff to get ready for January 2014?
I know that advocates are deeply concerned about outreach and enrollment. We're very good at that. So that doesn't keep me up at night. I think, matter of fact, I kind of know where that population we're going to be bringing in is getting their health care now. They're getting it through free care clinics in our state that we're very familiar with. They are also getting it from FQHCs. And so we know where that population is getting their care now. And so I'm not so worried about reaching them and getting them enrolled in my system. I'm a lot more worried about what kind of network we'll have available of providers to treat them than I am about getting them enrolled. It'll be, I think, more of the same. We certainly learned lessons. We certainly can't use a paper-bound process. We know that even at our best intent, we're going to have people in blended families that will be bridging these programs. We're going to have people in the exchange, and they're going to have maybe stepchildren in CHIP and their children in Medicaid. I don't know. It's going to be a blended world, and so we're going to have to recognize that we're going to have to go the extra mile to help those families that are in multiple situations and multiple plans.
Yes, go ahead.
Jill Wexler with Managed Healthcare Executive Magazine. I believe in the 1099 legislation that was passed a few months ago that individuals who get subsidies and then earn more money in the following year now will have to pay that money back. And I'm wondering how you see that adding to the complexity or the attractiveness of these systems.
And let me just add to the complexity of that. One of the points that was made in our discussion of ACOs last week was the need for timely data. And it seems to me that's another instance where we're going to need very timely data. And if you've got an open season in the fall and a tax filing deadline the following spring referring to the previous year, you got some problems. Pam, you want to start us on that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. As it was originally passed, the Affordable Care Act did require people to pay back some small amount of the premium credits that were advanced to them in the exchanges if their incomes turned out to be higher than anticipated. The starting point for that is really that the premium credits will be calculated in advance at this fall open season so that people know, at least have that much information about what the government is going to kick in through the premium credits and therefore what they might have to pay if they sign up for insurance in the exchanges. And since not everybody has that kind of cash sitting around, the credits will be made available in advance rather than saying, okay, you sign up, pay for it, and we'll pay you back when you at the end of the year when you file your taxes. So, but ultimately, the premium credits that people receive will depend on the income that they earn during the coverage year, which will not be known until they get to the end of the year and they're filing their taxes. So where people's incomes do increase appreciably, they could end up having to settle up with the IRS at the end of the year. I have some real concerns about expecting people to pay back a lot and expecting people to make decisions about buying insurance when they don't know what it's going to cost them.
And, I mean, my feeling is that this is ultimately a voluntary system and that that payback will have a chilling effect and keep people from signing up for insurance. There are some things that could be, and, you know, there's certainly the administrative costs of getting that money back. It's not clear to me that it wouldn't be better even to reduce the if you could in a budget neutral way kind of figure out what you were going to get back in the payback or some part of it, if you even made the subsidies a little less generous but certain up front, that might actually do better in terms of getting people to sign up, and they would certainly be much happier not getting to the end of the year and doing their taxes and saying, oh, gee, I owe a couple thousand dollars. These are not families that mostly are going to have a spare couple thousand dollars laying around.
Just, and the flip side, though, too, people whose incomes actually drop get more subsidy. So there's that.
Well, that's true. They get more subsidy, but if they were way off, you know, noticeably off, the fact that they weren't going to get as much that much subsidy might prevent them from signing up for a plan in the first place, and then there wouldn't be anything to subsidize if you don't get them in. It actually, I did some simulations of this in an article that's referenced among the materials, and it actually turns out that not requiring people to pay back the subsidy is a good way to encourage participation in the voluntary system, because you're talking about people who have more income than they expected, and they get more if they don't have to pay it back, they've got the subsidies, and they're the people who are most likely to use that extra income in keeping with a little more generous subsidies to sign up.
Pam, we had a question on a card that's related to this. You had mentioned that states could choose to extend coverage for Medicaid to the end of the year to help align the time periods. And the question is, what authority or flexibility do the states have to do that? And let me just add to that the question of whether or not states have any flexibility or power to deal with the exchange subsidy problem that you just outlined in a similar way.
Well, the exchange subsidies are federal through the tax system, so the states don't have direct say over that. There is a program called Transitional Medical Assistance that allows people who lose their Medicaid eligibility because of an increase in earnings to stay on the program for a while. I mean, one of the things we haven't really said is that when people go to work or they earn more and you penalize them for that by taking away their health insurance, it can have a chilling effect in terms of whether or not they are going to earn that money, maybe even a bigger effect on whether or not they report earning that money. That's a general concern and one that's already been acknowledged in the transitional medical assistance. And then as well, there are some options for 12 months of continuous coverage that have been built into some of these programs, and it's sort of in that same spirit that I think there is the flexibility without, you know, through decisions that CMS would make or existing authority for states to keep people on. We talked, there was mention of walls dividing people from Medicaid from commercial insurance, but I want people to also have in mind that this is a hugely dynamic process that we live with right now. Something like a couple million people every month are uninsured and get coverage, and another couple million people lose their coverage, and people move in and out of Medicaid all the time. That doesn't happen, you know, and many people are uninsured or uninsured for relatively short periods, I think about half of them for 6 months or so. So there's a lot of turnover, a lot of churning that occurs within this one-year window that the ACA has in mind. And part of our challenge here, where we really can make a difference, I think, is to keep some of that from occurring and let people stay in place for longer periods of time, up to a year. That would be a real improvement, to be able to stay in place for the rest of the year, let alone move on eventually from Medicaid to a commercial plan.
Thanks, Ed. Carl Pulser, American Healthcare Association. And just a note, when policymakers are thinking about policies like continuous eligibility to help promote continued continuity of coverage and care and reduce churning, just to think about, this goes beyond the exchange, because Medicaid is going to intersect with private health insurance in a much greater way all across the market, not just in the exchange, but in every workplace in America, as folks are now eligible, among the low-wage workers. So employers have an incentive to educate employees about Medicaid. And what happens in the same way in the workplace when wages go up or family income changes, family composition changes, the same issues arise about continuity. And so when we think about, just a question, I guess, in the form of an answer or whatever, when we think about these policies, they need to be thought about maybe across the whole market, with the exchanges a very important part of that. Just your response. Thank you.
I think that it's not commonly known that a large number of the people that are currently Medicaid eligible also have private insurance, and Medicaid often is a second payer for those services. I know that one of the things in my state, there are probably 230,000+ individuals that are Medicaid eligible and also have private insurance, and all that Medicaid pays is the copay and deducts for those individuals, and we want them to keep that private insurance. And so we have a very vigorous program where we will, where it's cost effective for us to do, we will pay their insurance premiums so that they can keep that private coverage, because it's cheaper for Medicaid to do so.
I agree. I think that, again, the theme is consistency across programs, and so that Medicaid has to interface with the employer coverage is absolutely right. And then we have to think about the individual who turns 65 may remain eligible for Medicaid and becomes a dual eligible, just the way, you know, they may be getting commercial coverage or employer coverage and they become 65 and Medicare comes into the picture. So this is both the opportunity and the challenge, I think, that we face right now. And we have to think beyond the walls of the exchange, even as we bring Medicaid, in my terms, into the exchange.
I also think that it's unclear how many employers are actually going to come into the exchange and buy their employees' coverage. I mean, the states have the option to expand the exchanges, to employers with more than 100 employees starting in 2016. And I think there's a big question mark about, I think employers are eyeing this as a market shaper potentially. So we may have a case where we have a lot more employers bringing their employees into the exchange. And that raises a lot of questions, again, for these transitions that Pam points out in her paper, allowing merging the two exchanges, the individual and the small and the business exchanges, so that people, when they change their job and buy it on their own, can actually still buy within the same marketplace, the same exchange, without having to move actually to a different exchange. So I think the employer piece of this is really kind of a wild card, and how that pie chart that I showed where people are gaining their coverage, how much of that employer coverage is actually going to be purchased through the exchanges.
Hello, Jim Kaufman with the National Association of Children's Hospitals. Deborah, you made a comment about the modeling that you're doing is basing Medicaid at 120% to look at access. Well, right now, Medicaid pays on average about 30% less than Medicare. So even at 120%, if I'm doing my math correctly, it's still going to be 15% below Medicare for the exact same services. Don, you made a comment about how Medicaid is going to be a growing market share. Do you think states are going to have to deal with their Medicaid reimbursement rates to actually ensure access to care as the market grows, or as they're adding more Medicaid beneficiaries to the program, the states are actually going to have to go the opposite direction to deal with their budgetary pressures?
No, I actually think the former. I think when we have a larger market share, we're going to have to do a better job at being a payer for services than we do today, because, quite frankly, Medicaid, no one likes to say it out loud, but Medicaid's been a cost shifter. Medicaid is underpaid, and other insurers have picked up that underpayment over time, and not only in my state, but every state that I'm aware of. And that's, as Medicaid becomes a bigger part of the market, it simply is not going to be able to do that.
I agree with what Don said, and I would add to that, I think Medicaid has to be a smarter payer as well, so that, you know, we know, and you know, that in pediatrics, obstetrics, and mental health, we are a major payer, and we how we pay dictates access much more than how much we pay for cardiac surgery. So we have to be cognizant of that. We have to know where we need access and where we can't do across the board increases or decreases. And two, payment methods can be as important, and this is another one of my favorite themes. As much as payment levels, it's how we pay. And, you know, we still have states that are paying based on institution-specific cost basis or paying per diems or paying off of base years that date back to the 1980s. So I think Medicaid has to be a smarter payer. It includes payment levels, payment methods then we have to move into, and then we can move into some of the more innovative payment policies that are we see emerging now from CMMI.
Sarah and I have about 650 green cards with questions, so I urge you to go to a microphone if you want to be absolutely certain that your question gets asked. In the meantime, Sarah, if you want to pick one out, I've got one that I've been dying to read. It's a hypothetical situation. A man and a woman have three children but do not live together. She has the children. He is obligated to support them but cannot claim them. She is in poverty with $22,000 a year in income. He is out of poverty at $10,000 a year in income. How will he buy insurance? How will he pay the penalty? How will he eat? Any suggestions for this gentleman?
We would, in an eligibility process, particularly looking at the family, the wife and the kids, and we're not so concerned about how he eats, we would be looking at at the income that's available to them in determining their health care coverage. And if he's not contributing, not doing what he is obligated to do, we certainly wouldn't hold the children and the spouse accountable for that.
And there are affordability provisions in the ACA, that, are there not, Sarah, that allow you to avoid the impact of the mandate?
That's right. So he has set $10,000 income, because I'm trying to understand, he would be eligible for Medicaid under the law. And I'm not understanding the family composition implications, because I don't know the eligibility, how that will work out. If she were to apply too with $22,000, she is also eligible for Medicaid under the law. So both of those will have no premium obligation, very little cost sharing obligation. So they're moving into a world that they're much more protected than they are today. So eating will be much more possible under 2014.
On $10,000 in income.
You're right.
As we get to these last few minutes of Q&A, I would urge you to both listen to the answers and fill out the blue evaluation forms as you listen. Sarah, do you have any card questions that are right at the top of the list there?
There's a question about the premium credit provisions in the law, so that the credit, do the credits cover the entire premium? What does it mean when it covers 2 to 9.5%? I mean, 2 to 9.5% of income. What does that mean in terms of share of the premium that people are actually responsible for to paying for? Anyone have a?
Well, the share that people are responsible for goes up as income goes up, so it's graduated with income. So that's the first point. I'm kind of forgetting what the rest of the question was.
So essentially, the income caps people's premiums. The premium caps cap people's premium contributions at a share of their income. And so that will break out into a certain percent of the income, a certain share of the premium, and that goes up as their income goes up. The Commonwealth Fund has done some analyses of these, and the share is really quite high at lower income levels, and it goes, it predictably goes down at higher income levels. An important provision, too, in the law, and it's not gotten a lot of attention, is how these are adjusted over time. So they, my understanding, originally, at least under one of the bills early on, was that the people's premium obligations would be fixed in their first year. So your cap would fix it in your first year. And then as premiums grew over time, the share of the premium would actually remain the same. So you might end up paying more as a share of your income over time as the premium growth rates were adjusted. But I think that it's somewhat of a complicated issue.
This one is originally targeted to Deborah. What information do states need to make decisions about the basic health program? When can we expect to know which states will choose to run a BHP, and do you know if CMS has issued guidance on that subject?
CMS has not issued guidance yet, and there are an awful lot of questions because they start with 95% of what? Because you get 95% of the subsidies that otherwise would have gone to these individuals, so we have to figure out what's the 95% of what. We need to know if the offset for cost sharing is at 100% or 95%. None of that is clear. And then we have to model whether there's enough dollars available in order to provide a benefit package that is at least, and to make any sense, it has to be richer than what the individual would have had access to through the exchange. And then the question will be what plans, what provider networks. So there's some amount of information that needs to be, we need to hear from CMS on. Another one, and Stan brings this up in his paper, so I'll give him credit for the first one to alert me to this, I got your attention, was how do we do risk sharing? Can we use the same risk sharing between BHP and QHPs, which would mitigate the loss of individuals from our exchange or QHP population? So that's an open question for CMS. But states are starting to do the modeling, even with the open questions with respect to CMS at this point.
And I would like to add on the Medicaid side, you know, they have this new eligibility process for families and children where it's MAGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income, and CMS has yet to define that. We do know that our current eligibility systems will not do that, whatever it is. We've taken a guess that it's an IRS 1040 line 37, and we've done a gap analysis between our current eligibility processes and what that looks like. And so we're working with that assumption, but if CMS doesn't fairly soon make some kind of definition of what MAGI is, where the states are going to be in deep trouble, I've got to issue an RFP this summer to revamp my eligibility system to do MAGI, and as I said here, I don't know what that is.
Could somebody just spend a minute or so explaining why that got put into the law and what impact it has on the current state operations in Medicaid in figuring income eligibility?
I really don't know. I think it was to provide a uniform standard, if you will, for income across the states, because every state has been free to kind of adopt its own processes. It causes a complication for us, at least in our early analysis, in as much as if we're guessing correctly that MAGI is a 1040 line 37, we've done the analysis and we know there are some children that would be disadvantaged by that income process that are currently eligible but will not qualify under MAGI. Well, there's a maintenance of effort standard under ACA, which means that we may have to run a double eligibility process for any kid that doesn't qualify for under MAGI, to run them through our current process, CE, to make sure that they're not disadvantaged under the new rules. So that really makes it more complicated to build an eligibility system that will do all of this.
I think we are expecting CMS guidance on this by the end of June is what I understand, not that I have any special information. And I think coming back to the reason for MAGI, which was part of an effort, as least I understand it, to simplify the process for individuals to, you know, to secure an eligibility determination and to enroll in Medicaid. And consistent with that, I'm cautiously optimistic that the regulations and defining MAGI and defining this this shadow system will actually eliminate the need for shadow system so that we can use things like proxy. Because the overarching message of the ACA, as I read it, is that we want to streamline the eligibility and enrollment process so individuals who are eligible for coverage can get on coverage and keep that coverage.
And I believe it was in part to help facilitate the coordination of Medicaid eligibility with eligibility for the premium credits, which are will be in the framework of the federal tax system. So the numbers all work out. You know, under 133%, you're on Medicaid, then you switch over to premium credits. But if you're not defining income with a consistent yardstick, you can have gaps and overlaps, and that's not something that anybody wants.
A question about something that has been raised earlier. Can you speak to the issues associated with Medicaid eligibility being based on point-in-time income versus the subsidies being based on annual income over the course of the year in which they were received? How do you make that work?
Well, I think this is one of the other things that CMS is going to have to speak to. But the legislation has a specific provision that says there's nothing here related to modified adjusted gross income, you know, means that states can't continue to evaluate Medicaid eligibility based on income at time of application. But exactly what that's going to mean, I don't think we know yet. But that will be critical. Again, it's this idea, you can imagine people moving along a yardstick that's measuring their income, and at some point you pass a line and you move from one program to the other. It's not going to work if we have two different yardsticks, and one's in meters, and you know, it's in the metric system, and one's in the old English system. We got to have a consistent way of measuring.
Got a question here that looks like an appropriate panel ending question. If there was one thing you'd like to see CMS include in the regulation on exchange and Medicaid eligibility to keep coverage continuous, what would it be? I can ask another question to give you time to think about that question.
I can tell you one of the things that has certainly benefited us in our processes is we adopted early on the 12 months continuous eligibility, and we also adopted a rolling renewal. Whenever we have an opportunity to have an interaction with a family, for whatever reason, if they call up to report a change of address, somebody moved in, somebody moved out, we'll take that opportunity to ask a few quick questions and renew their eligibility and extend it for another 12 months. So we both that 12 months continuous eligibility and rolling renewals whenever we have an opportunity for contact have been critical in us reducing churn and keeping people on our rolls for extended period of times. And a point that I didn't make in my presentation is so critical about churn is if you don't have 12 months of continuous eligibility, you can't do HEDIS measures. So you don't even know how good the quality is of the health care that you're delivering to the people in your eligibility system because it can't be measured. And so you got to have at least 12 months of continuous eligibility to even know if you're improving the health outcomes.
Let me just clarify, Don, you have the power to do that now, and other states could do it without CMS having to do anything additional, right? or not?
Yes, for children. For adults, it's a little bit more complicated. It took us a long time to get CMS approval to do 12-month continuous for adults, but you can do it very easily for children. So I agree with everything Don said, and then I would go back to this issue of point in time versus annual calculation of, 12-month calculation of income eligibility that needs to be resolved consistent across Medicaid and exchange subsidies with an eye towards the payback issue that Pam spoke to. But if you put all of that together, we're moving towards a system where individuals can get on and stay on without fear of losing coverage or out fear of an unaffordable payback.
Yeah, I think the vision that I'm pushing is one where most people would be able to sign up for insurance in the fall or sign up for insurance and know they're going to have it for the next year, and that they would get help paying for that through these various mechanisms, also in a way that would be as predictable as possible. And frankly, to the extent we can afford it, I think it needs to be as generous as possible. This is going to be a voluntary system. If we don't want to hit people with a club if they don't get coverage, and we want most people to be covered, then we have to make it as easy as possible for them to sign up, and we have to give them as much help paying for it as we can afford.
And I agree with everyone on the panel. I also hope that on the recoupment issue that CMS pays very close attention to Pam's issue brief on all the ways that we can actually improve this and make it easy for people to keep their coverage even when their income changes. Also, I think a point that Deborah makes that I hadn't fully grasped was the ACA requires eligibility coordination across the different kinds of premium subsidies and Medicaid enrollment, but not so much on the enrollment side. So I guess I'd like to see an emphasis not only on coordinating the eligibility, but making sure that the enrollment, people choose plans within the exchange regardless of whether they're eligible for Medicaid or for private subsidized coverage.
Okay, there's the agenda. We can come back to it in a few months and see if CMS paid any attention to us. Thanks to you for...
Send them the video link.
There you go. And to reiterate what Pam was referring to, you can watch the webcast of this on Monday at kff.org and relive every wonderful moment, including pictures of you filling out evaluation forms, which if you haven't done yet, we'd appreciate if you're doing. Thanks to our colleagues at the Commonwealth Fund, most specifically, Sarah, for helping shape this, putting the paper in Pam Short's capable hands to get the information in front of us. Thank you for sticking with what can have been a pretty technical discussion of insurance markets and eligibility rules. And I'd like to ask you to help me thank the panel for answering those tough questions.